something that, without a doubt, just as we look back on the student protests against the Vietnam War now and the uprisings in 1968 in support of Black liberation, in the ways that Columbia touts that legacy now and created an entire infrastructure of a disciplinary system out of the 1968 uprisings at Columbia, where over 700 students engaged in building occupations, that legacy is now glorified at Columbia. They teach classes about the 1968 uprisings. And yet today, they are committing exactly the same, not just errors, but harms against their students. They had hundreds of us arrested. They suspended hundreds of students initially. And now I am effectively expelled. Other students are facing multi-year suspensions. And all of this in the history books will look exactly the same. That we know the side of history we're standing on, and it is a morally righteous one, and Columbia will look like an absolute shame and stain on academic freedom and rights to protest in this country.
And Catherine Curran Groom, you were talking about the distinction between a private university and a public university. I was in New York City last November. I was born in the New York City area. And I went to Columbia University to speak with somebody, to interview somebody. And I had to get a QR code onto my smartphone to get onto the Columbia University campus. Now, this is one of the most prestigious university campuses, certainly in the United States and in the world. And I'm accustomed to, in my mind, you know, a person of my age, I think about universities being public spaces, although of course they're not, right? They're not really legally speaking public spaces, but morally, ethically, we see university campuses, places that the public can walk through Boston Harvard Commons, they can walk through the Yale campus, they can stroll onto the Columbia University campus, and or the University of Toronto campus in Canada, or UBC. Even though these are, strictly speaking, you know, private spaces, and the university has the right to prevent people from entering those spaces, you know, it's kind of not something I'm accustomed to. And so I got onto the Columbia University campus. I had a few conversations with security people as I was going in, right? Because I would not go softly, right? Even though I had the QR code on my smartphone, I engaged in conversations with decent people who were security guards. It wasn't their fault. And, you know, one of them was actually sympathetic. And I was saying, this is like a high security area. Like, how is this possible in the United States, the land of the free and the home of the brave? That a campus like Columbia can be a closed security zone.
Yeah. And I think you're not the only one asking those questions. There have recently, and over the past year and a half, as Columbia began to securitize more and more heavily, as they began, initially campus would just be shut down when we would announce our protests. They would shut it down for the day of our protest. And then during the encampments, Hinds Hall and since, they have decided to enforce complete closures of campus, which the community, which Columbia has actively gentrified and harmed for decades, the Harlem community, which Columbia University sits in, used to have access. That used to be a public right of way. The main college walk through campus was a public right of way. And now Columbia has decided that they will not only theoretically be an ivory tower, but quite literally in its physical manifestation, be an ivory tower where it has these massive looming gates that are padlocked. And they have these checkpoints to enter campus. I mean, David, you've been to Palestine many times too. The literal physical infrastructure that Columbia was building on its campus in so many ways was modeled off of the Israeli occupation infrastructure across Palestine. They set up checkpoints where you could not cross without going through a security guard who sometimes will face check your ID to your face to make sure you're not sneaking in, who will sometimes go through your personal belongings if you want to just get onto campus to go to a class or to visit someone for an interview as you were. And for community members, good luck getting a guest pass to get onto campus. I mean, they have securitized to the point where they have installed hundreds of new cameras, including cameras using artificial intelligence technology, one of which is almost an exact replica of the AI cameras that are used at the checkpoints around Al-Khalil, around Hebron in the West Bank. And Colombia has decided that its rights as a private university supersede the rights of the community that it professes to be there in partnership with, to be there in support of. And so, yeah, Colombia has completely lost all moral standing on a number of fronts. It is no longer part of the community, if it ever was, which I would argue it wasn't. It has always committed harm against the Harlem community. It has heavily militarized the entire neighborhood, leading to massive NYPD presence at the gates and a huge private security infrastructure whereby they're hiring hundreds of guards. And so meanwhile, they don't have money to support critical studies on campus, money to support more scholarships, yet they can fund hundreds of thousands of dollars of security infrastructure just in the last few months since Hinds Hall. So I think it really calls into question whose safety Columbia is there for, because it's not there for mine. It's not there for any anti-Zionist student like me. It's not there for the Harlem community. So then who are these gates there to protect? Who are these cameras there to surveil? It really calls into question who these universities were built for, and they most certainly weren't built for people like us.
And our mutual friend, Mazen Kumsier, who is the founder and co-founder along with his partner, Jesse, and director of the Palestine Institute for Biodiversity and Sustainability in Bethlehem, a wonderful man, a biologist, a scientist, a communicator, who was going to be, and he was on the Green Planet Monitor last week. We had a good conversation. And he was going to be speaking at Columbia University, and that got canceled. Tell me about that.
Yeah, Mazen's was just the most recent, but this again is a long pattern of Columbia canceling any event, especially those with Palestinian speakers, but any event that is going to advocate an anti-Zionist narrative, a narrative that advances Palestinian liberation, not just in a theoretical framework, right? Because Columbia is okay with these conversations if they solely stay theoretical. But the second they actually begin to relate to how we put this theory into practice, what it means to not just call out complicity, but transform the systems that we're living under into systems of justice and care and accountability. And the second that our conversations move from the theoretical material, Columbia immediately cancels those events. And that is exactly what happened with Professor Mazen Kumsier. He was scheduled to host an event talking about ecocide, talking about environmental justice between the U.S., between Turtle Island and Palestine, to talk about the amazing work that he does out of the West Bank, out of their Institute for Biodiversity there. And even as a well-renowned, widely respected and beloved academic as Professor Kumsier is, Columbia still decided to attempt to repress and silence his narrative and the narrative that event would create by bringing people together with Professor Kumsier. And so last minute, we were told that the venue, which was technically an off-campus venue, but was student-affiliated, that Columbia was threatening disciplinary sanctions if those students went forward with hosting the event. And so we had to change it to another venue nearby where Professor Kumsier, alhamdulillah, was able to give his talk, and it was phenomenally well attended. Students loved getting to meet Professor Kumsier, and those are exactly the kinds of not just educational opportunities, but connections and relationship building that Columbia wants to stop. They're terrified by the potential that was unleashed in particular last spring during the encampments and building occupations, not just at Columbia, but across the country, for Palestine to be brought here in a material way. They were completely comfortable bringing academics like myself or Professor Kumsier or Joseph Massad when they felt that Palestine could be kept over there, that it could be kept this theoretical other that we would deal with in the classroom but would never actually come onto our campus. And what we've shown over the last year and a half is that Palestine has never been solely there. It is also here in so many ways, in so many manifestations, from our campus police to these sham disciplinary proceedings and apartheid rules infrastructures that these universities are creating in the exact replica of Zionist state institutions. And what this last year and a half have shown these universities that they are so terrified of is that Palestine cannot be boxed away into something solely theoretical, but that students and our communities more broadly have a growing consciousness of all the ways that Palestine is here, of all the ways that we have a duty to act when not only our universities, but our entire state is actively funding and fueling the genocide unfolding, the genocide that for many of us has led to the murder of our loved ones. And so that is what Columbia fears the most. It's not that Mazen, Professor Kumsia, is some scary person to them, but it's what he represents. It's what anyone who does the kind of work that Professor Kumsia does represents to them, which is a threat to their very fragile facade of academic freedom and the threat to make Palestine a reality here as well that can be understood by anyone, not just students, but anyone walking the streets can understand the ways in which fighting for Palestine here on Turtle Island is integral and interconnected to all of our liberations, because Palestine in many ways, in my opinion, is not only our compass, but is the pathway to our collective liberation. Until we free Palestine, none of us can truly be free. And as one of our co-defendants from Hinds Hall said when we were in a state-mandated anti-Semitism training following Hinds Hall, he said, "I want to free Palestine because I won't know what it's like to love until Palestine is free." And I think that is one of the most beautiful ways that someone who has never been to Palestine can feel such a deep, intimate connection to what the Palestinian struggle for liberation means to each of us here as well.
And I'm wondering, Catherine, what impact all of these events over the past year are having, have had on the consciousness of students on campus, on the Columbia University campus, students who may have been sympathetic to Palestine, but perhaps were, you know, not involved directly, were not activists, maybe didn't even protest, whether or not students are they're, you know, pursuing an incredibly expensive academic career in this prestigious academic institution, realizing that the institution is possibly corrupt to the core. And so how are the students, how do you think student consciousness on the Columbia University campus is evolving? If you can answer that question.
Yeah, I think this was a really intentional choice made in deciding to use encampments as a tactic. It was obviously not a novel or unique tactic. It's one that's been used across social justice movements for decades, including on Columbia University's campus. We found photos from some alumni back in the anti-apartheid struggle against South Africa. They had set up small encampments outside of the same library where we hosted ours. There were, of course, the Occupy encampments in New York City, the encampments of Tahrir and the Arab Spring. And so it wasn't a novel or unique tactic, but what drew us to it, instead of initially something like a building occupation, was its accessibility, its ability to reach people whose consciousness we hoped could continue to be raised. Not everyone, of course, is at a point in their political development or in their connection to the Palestinian struggle for liberation to be ready to take a building. Back on April 17th, that base was not there yet. But what was there was a lot of students who were desperately craving community, which Columbia had continued to take away from us. We no longer had classrooms to talk about Palestine, really. We no longer had spaces on campus to protest because they denied every single political education event. Like, Palestinian Resistance 101, we could not find space for on campus. Every single one of our protests that we tried to get sanctioned early on could not get approval. And so Columbia was shrinking the kind of not just educational space, but civic space to engage in Palestine on campus. And so what students were desperately craving was a space to be in community with one another. And that's what the encampments provided, a porous space that students could join and could leave if they wanted to. They could come and go as they pleased. They could attend, professors' lectures in the encampment. They could also come in and get food and just sit with people and learn about why they were there. It was a community that I think represented, of course, with all of its flaws, but represented everything that we are struggling for, a community that took care of itself, took care of one another, and allowed for people to come in where they were at and develop from there. And I think that was really the beauty of the encampments, and what posed such a threat to the university was that it did lead to mass consciousness raising. It was a mass radicalization event, not because the encampment in and of itself was all that radical. It was a bunch of students and community members pitching tents, getting food from all across the city. You know, people were driving from restaurants. People were driving from the Arab communities of Northern Jersey, bringing in like massive pots of matluba. We had indigenous healers and herbalists who were coming in and providing, ear acupuncture treatments from the Black Panther Party. And there were just all of these beautiful, really organic representations of what it can look like for our communities to care for one another. And to have that done within the container of a Gaza Solidarity encampment, for everyone to understand that it was Palestine, that it was the people of Gaza who were providing the opportunity for us to engage in such a beautiful and resilient example of what it looks like to build our own independent and autonomous communities was so radicalizing for students in such a beautiful way. It's not the kind of thing that we can ever tell someone about in a lecture or even in a podcast. What the encampments provided was the physical, the material space for people to engage in that process themselves. And so that led to mass radicalization. And so by the time we decided to take Hinds Hall, by the time, you know, for the masses, and I would say I came to this realization much earlier on, but that was because of my experiences with the administration and my understanding of what academia can and can't provide us. But when the masses in the encampment realized that the university was never negotiating with us in good faith, they never intended to actually meet any of our demands in that moment, and that they were going to unleash not only police violence, but at the time they were threatening National Guard on our encampment. And so it became very clear to students that they are not somehow an equal or fair negotiating partner, but that the Columbia University administration was an enemy of the people, was an enemy of the Palestinian liberation struggle, and that they had to be treated as such. And so that kind of mass radicalization, it wasn't because anyone told students to think that way. It was because they actually got to live through the experience of being targeted, of being repressed, of having the police unleashed on them. And in the face of all of that, to be loved and supported by this community that was growing by the day in its numbers, in its strength, in its principles. And I think that was the radicalization that happened. It was nothing that I nor anyone else who was an organizer on campus did. It was a truly organic and ultimately Hinds Hall a much more spontaneous outcome than any of us could have expected.
Two last questions, Catherine. You've been wonderful. My penultimate question is a very, very big one, and then I'll ask you the simple question. Here's the big penultimate question. What's going on in the United States today? And are you afraid? Are you worried?
Oh, yeah, that is a big one. There's a lot going on in the United States today.
I mean, there's genocide going on in Gaza. Israel USA is committing, has committed, and is continuing to commit genocide in Gaza. And Donald Trump is now it's almost impossible to believe. He's talking about admitting that it's a demolition zone, which is admitting the genocide has been committed, and demanding that the Palestinians get out, and that the whole thing be bulldozed and turned into a Riviera that he can invest in and turn a profit on, building Trump Towers from the top to the bottom. It's almost too much to believe. And so this is, you know, in the course of all this, you know, university, you can't protest on a university campus anymore. So what's going on in the United States, without getting into the genocide in Gaza, that's too big. What's going on in the United States?
Yeah, I would say, I mean, to try to put it as simply as possible, we are in, I would say historically throughout social movements, we go through periods of ebb and flow, and that what we saw in the spring was a moment of mass uprising, was a huge peak for the, not just the student movement, but the movement for Palestinian liberation here in the US, but across the globe. And what naturally happened after that was that peak began to subside, and we went into a valley of repression, and that is what we are currently climbing out of. But that, as is true with all social movements throughout history, we will never stay in those valleys, and that we are, I believe, in this moment on very much an upward trend of rising again, and that we have moments to come that will be even greater and more significant than the Gaza solidarity encampments and building occupations of the last year. But in this moment, we are very much in a, what I would say is head-to-head battle with repressive forces, that the goal of the Trump administration's executive orders that are coming out by the dozen, by the day right now, including orders trying to target any students, especially international students who participated in any protests or solidarity actions in support of Gaza and the Palestinian people last year, is that they are trying to instill a climate of fear, which is the goal of repression. They want to make an example out of some of us, be it people like myself, Aiden and Brandon, as students with still, despite all the harms we faced, immense privilege in the fact that we are American citizens with certain protections here in this country. And now they are trying to make an example out of some of our most marginalized comrades, being undocumented comrades and students here on F-1 visas, trying to show that if you step out of line, we will take your access to this country away, to these institutions away. And I think the reason this lawsuit is so important to me in this climate of repression and climate of fear that not just the Trump administration, but these university administrations, congressional committees are seeking to cultivate across this country, is that we continue to fight back. When we face repression, we do not take it lying down. We do not just accept that our movements will be retaliated against and silenced, but that we find all of the creative and diverse ways that we can fight back against that. And this lawsuit to me is one of those. This is us saying that we will not take the evictions, the expulsions, the sanctions, the loss of housing, of healthcare. We are not just going to take that and accept it as if that is some fair punishment. Punishment for what? For standing against a genocide? And we will not let that narrative nor those material harms, we won't take those lying down. And so this lawsuit is also an offensive action against the university, saying that we will not allow you to escape accountability for the harms you've inflicted upon us or students like us. And if you won't be held accountable through your internal processes, which they have absolutely failed because we have attempted internal accountability for the last year and a half, then we will seek external accountability and we will go to the courts. And that is what we're doing. But that is not whatsoever the only example of counter-repression that we are seeing in the U.S. right now. We are seeing massive, massive numbers out in the streets defending our community members against ICE raids, saying that if you come for one of us, you have to come for all of us. And I think these moments of how we respond and not only respond in the moment to repression, but how we are actively organizing to counter that repression. So it is not a reactionary tactic, but it is actually a proactive tactic. That is going to be critically important in these coming months, because the Trump administration, these university administrations, are testing the water to see what they can create as a new normal. And every inch we give them, they will double down on. And so we, not just those of us who identify as being in the Palestine movement, but all of our movements, which are inherently interconnected against these fascist and repressive forces that are seeking to cultivate this climate of fear, how we act right now and in the months to come will be critically important for the ability for our movements to continue to grow and create new peaks like what we saw last spring with the student intifada. And if we decide to wait it out and see how bad the repression is going to get, we have seen that strategy in the past and it has always failed. We have to take proactive action right now. And I think not just students, but communities across the US and across the globe are doing exactly that in so many ways, including a few weeks ago, actions at Columbia that included cementing the sewage pipelines at the School of International and Public Affairs, which is deeply complicit in both NYPD operations and Israeli military operations, and another action that targeted the business school, which is one of the most recent gentrification projects into Harlem by Columbia. And so I think as much as Columbia wants to instill this culture of fear by suspending and repressing us, and in the same ways that Donald Trump and the state is doing, people are not taking it lying down, and that we have to increase our coordination and increase the sentiment that it is all of our duty to fight back in whatever ways we can.
Okay, last question, or a couple of nuts and bolts questions. What's the timeline for your litigation? What are the key dates we should be anticipating, looking for, like a hearing before the New York State Supreme Court? And how can people help your litigation? I presume you're being represented pro bono. Is there a fund, a way for people to help out?
Yeah, so the timeline, as I understand it now, and I'm of course not a lawyer, so nothing I've said today being proper legal advice or analysis. The timeline, as I understand it, is they have 20 days to respond from the time that they were served. They were served last week. So by the end of the month, Columbia will have had to give a response, and then it will proceed from there. And then what was the second part of your question?
And so, you know, end of February, Columbia University's got to respond, and then it'll get, you know, rattle around inside the New York State Supreme Court. And I presume you're being represented pro bono, but there are always costs filing affidavits. And I've been involved in this, and I was represented for like 5 years pro bono on a totally different case. But there's lots of expenses in terms of photocopying and filing and notarization and up the yin yang. How can people help funding wise?
Yeah, I really appreciate that question. So far, we have been working with a team of pro bono attorneys, one of whom is Jonathan Wallace, who has done immense work over the last many years in support of student movements and First Amendment freedoms. And the second attorney on the case is James Carlson, who is actually a co-defendant of mine from Hinds Hall and is a lawyer himself. And so I think it's been really beautiful to see how those of us who engage in actions together, those are not temporary relationships. They are relationships that we sustain throughout our lives, because to engage in action together is a deep commitment to one another, is a deep trust that we have to have in one another in order to do something like what we did with claiming Hinds Hall in honor of Hindu Rajab. And so the fact that James has continued his support of our cases all the way through helping us file this lawsuit, I think really speaks.
Radio Rewind.